Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Here in South Africa, where we're under black rule and have been under black rule for 29 years, it is fashionable and legal to cheat whites and steal from whites. And I've been watching the waning fortunes of all whites around me. But I've been watching other whites elsewhere, where these globalist systems are slowly destroying them too. And COVID has really helped to speed things up. COVID collapsed a lot of the world's economy and has caused chaos in stock markets for at least 2 years. It seems to now be settling down. But I've spoken to various supporters of mine in different countries where they've explained to me some of the problems that they've had since COVID. And also, some of my supporters have been getting tired of their normal day jobs. They've been getting more and more sick of this daily grind as they discover and realize that whites are just being screwed over. One American friend of mine, a guy that I've known for almost 20 years, and he's in a high-paying job in computers, he said to me that he's earning a big amount of money, and the amount of taxes he's paying and what he's left with at the end of the month, he's just barely managing to survive. And he said he's driving an old car. And he said to me that he thinks it's as if things are working out so that whatever your income, you end up just breaking even. It doesn't matter how much you're earning. The amount of money that he was paying in taxes when converted to South African rands is more money than I was earning as a full-time computer programmer here in South Africa. So he's paying in tax more than my entire gross earnings in the days when I was fully employed and at the peak of my salary earning ability. So he's pretty annoyed with things. And I've had other people tell me that they've quit their jobs. They quit their jobs, they got sick of it. One guy in another country said he decided to do activism, got involved in activism. But the bottom line is that there are whites outside of Africa, in North America and so forth, who are starting to realize that, you know what, the system is screwing me over. And I'm just working like a dog and I'm not going anywhere. In South Africa, we've got quite a lot of whites, especially Afrikaans whites, who want to commit suicide because life is so tough. And then there's the youth. And the younger people have told me, and it is clear to see, that there is no future for them. I used to have a young guy who was a supporter. He was maybe 15 or more years younger than me, and now he lives in Britain. And he told me, even a few years ago, he said to me, "Jan, I'm in computers, I'm doing a good job, I'm being paid good money, and I will never be able to own property. I won't be able to own property." And here in South Africa, when I look at the youngsters as well, if they're lucky enough to get a job, there is no long-term future for them. That, as tough as things were for me, it's actually even worse for the youngsters. Then, of course, there was COVID, which also hit people hard. I heard from different people here in South Africa about how many people they knew lost their businesses. I met a locksmith the one day, and he told me that his entire business went bankrupt. And lots of people have lost their businesses. People have even lost their homes. And then, of course, you've got the creeping moves made by these black communists to drive people out of work. They rather employ blacks drive, white side of jobs. And this is going on constantly in South Africa. So white people struggle more and more. There was a guy I deal with who's in the car business, and he has his own little car business, and he's struggling. And he told me that he used to work for these big corporates in the same way that I used to work for these big corporates, whom I now spit on these days. And he worked for these big corporates, and now in his older age and desperation, he's tried to go back again. And they won't. They won't take him in. He's worked for them before, and now he's applying for a job again, and they won't let him in. So all these things are working in such a way that whites are struggling more and more. And in South Africa, it's bad. But if you look around, even in other countries, people are starting to struggle in ways that they didn't do before. I think I've even heard of American farmers going out of business. And then one of the untold stories is that big business in America is destroying farmers. Luckily, America is huge, and so there are still lots of farmers around, but big corporate businesses are destroying farmers. In South Africa, the Jewish-owned Anglo-American Corporation, which is a mining company, is a big landowner, and it is buying up farms like crazy. Anglo-American at one point owned 70% of South Africa's economy. That in and of itself is a whole scam, because the mines that they own are mines that used to belong to the Boers. But we're not going to discuss that today. And those of us who are in the white right, those of us who've been trying to tell the truth on the internet, no matter what truth you've been trying to tell, you will know that big businesses have come and they make a big show of smashing us down, of defunding us, of taking facilities away from us. Even though we are exercising our right to free speech, nothing we are doing is illegal, but they decide, they, and they're not government agencies, they decide that we are not allowed to earn money. I have looked at all kinds of things in the many years that I've been on the internet. Back in 2008, when Google adverts came out, there was a white guy that I worked with here in South Africa, and at the time the World Cup soccer was here in South Africa. And this young Afrikaans guy said to me, "Oh Jan, I've put up a website and I'm using Google adverts and I'm earning a lot of money. You must use Google adverts on your website." I was skeptical because I'm a right winger, I'm racialist. But I decided, okay, let's do that. So I set up some Google adverts and I started getting a little bit of money coming in. That was 2008. And then I thought, oh, this is pretty cool. And as the years went by, even as my traffic to my website was increasing, I noticed that the Google adverts were bringing in less and less money. And I began to realize that Google is changing its algorithms. Google is changing its algorithms so that those adverts don't work. And after about 5 or 6 years, I was getting about one-tenth of the amount of money that I had been getting from Google adverts in the beginning. And I must tell you, I've experimented with all kinds of things, spoken to people, looked at many things. And then, of course, there was PayPal that went on a huge spree to shut people down, defund people. There have been all kinds of attacks on whites. And all of it was based on going after white people who've got websites and who are just telling the truth. Nobody's lying. Nobody is involved in crime. Nobody is involved in crime. Nobody is doing anything illegal. They are just expressing their viewpoints, or they are putting out data and doing analysis on various subjects, whether it's historical or whatever, and they're getting clobbered. But nowadays, especially in South Africa, things are so bad, and the economy is very, very bad. And then, of course, you've still got the electricity, which is impacting businesses. And so whites are losing their income. They're either losing their businesses or they're losing their jobs. And those who still have jobs are clinging on to their jobs for all they're worth. I was talking to my doctor the one day, and I thought my doctor must be earning a pretty good amount of money. My doctor is a white Afrikaans guy, and he's got his practice in a very fancy medical center. What I didn't know was that he is renting his office, and that the different offices that are there go for different amounts of money. Anyhow, he had a pretty nice office, and he was always perky and happy. And then came COVID. And after COVID had been around for about a year, I hadn't gone to the doctor for quite a long time, and I went for my annual medical checkup, and to my amazement, he wasn't in his nice office that he always was in. That in actual fact, he was in a tiny, tiny little office sitting in a corner tucked away in the building, in a corner that I didn't even know existed. So I had quite a job finding my doctor. So I asked him, why is he here? And then he told me, no, he's here because this is the lowest renting office in the building. Now, while hospitals were making a ton of money out of COVID, it turned out that doctors, normal doctors, were actually losing out on their customers. Because now we had all these weird rules and regulations, and people couldn't come in as normal to see their doctors. So they had to reduce the number of people in the waiting rooms so as to stop infections and all that kind of garbage. And the doctor was actually making a lot less money than before. So anyway, one day I said to my doctor, because he's my age or maybe a little bit older, I said to him, so when are you going to go on retirement? And my doctor said to me, never. He said, I'm going to work until I drop dead. So that's a guy who's got a high education, he's got a job where he's always employed, and he's a mature white guy, he's knowledgeable, he's got good expertise, he should be in demand. And here he is, and he's battling along, and I can see that he's cutting costs and doing what he can. Now, years ago, when I started becoming politically active, I then would look at the economic situation and I'd see, man, things are not looking good. And I'd be saying to myself, and I'd even write it on my website, that you know what? I think these big corporations, they're gonna see their asses. And I couldn't wait for it. But I myself had worked in big corporates and was working in big corporate organizations, and I was hoping that these things would really struggle. But you know something that I saw, and I've seen this even in previous times, even under white rule in South Africa, is that whenever there are economic hardships, it is always the small guy who loses. Always the small guy who loses. The worker will lose his job. And the small business will be driven out of business by the big business. During this time of COVID, I also needed to get a pump fixed. So I dashed off to a shop that was a shop that had sold me a special pump, but they are involved in the lawnmower business, and pumps and irrigation and water tanks were also things that they sold. And these people were making a lot of money. They were a well-established business. They've been there for decades. And it's run by whites. And when I went there and I said to them, listen, I bought this thing from you a couple of years ago, but there's this fault with this thing. The white woman said to me, we don't deal in that stuff anymore. You may have bought it from us, but we don't look after those things anymore, and we don't deal with them at all anymore. So I was kind of miffed by this. I was quite irritated, and then I thought, well, let me go and see if I can find somebody else. It took me a while, but eventually I found a place, and it turned out to be a place that I'd actually seen many times before because I'd lived in that part of Randburg. And it was a place that was quite a big business. It was like a, for me, it was a big business, but in corporate terms, it was a mid-sized business. And this business was a wholesale business that specialized in pumps, but all kinds of varieties and also fittings and spares. And they had their own building that they owned. I can't remember if it's 3 stories high or whether it was just 2 stories high, but it was a nice solid building. And I now was looking for this business at this building, but when I got there, because I'd been told it is still there, but when I got there, I saw that most of the building is not that business anymore. Eventually, I had to go around the back. And I found the business. So I found this pump place. And I ended up having some good chats with the older white lady who was in charge. And we ended up having quite an interesting discussion. And later I even told her about my website. And she wrote it down because she was interested in going to have a look. But I told her, hey, you know, I went to that place over there and they were so rude. And now I'm coming to you. Can you help me? So then this lady says to me, well, that business that was rude to you, as well as our business, we used to have dealings with these big corporates, and the big corporates used to drive lots of work to us. But during the time of COVID, they changed their rules and they cut all of us. They cut all of us out of business. And it's hit us like a truck. And then she said to me, this building, we own this building, but you know, we've had to rent parts of it out to other businesses because we just don't have the business that we used to have. And this also is an old business. It's been around ever since I'd been in Randburg, and it's been there for decades, man. This is a well-established business. And we got talking, and she was telling me how these huge corporates are just destroying them. The huge corporates just pulled the plug on them and just smashed them, and they are battling to survive. They have shrunk by maybe like 75%. And one thing that I've seen over and over again is how big businesses crush small business. And the big businesses always win. They always win. At the worst, big businesses will merge with each other, and they'll merge and they'll bring their customer base together. And when they merge, they'll fire a whole ton of people, but they'll survive and they'll carry on. They'll kick you out on the street in 2 seconds, and they'll sink you, man. And you know what? What I realized when I was working in the corporate world, I realized this a long time ago. I realized that there's no such thing as loyalty. And as time went by, the corporate world disgusted me more and more. And I realized that there's no such thing as company loyalty. They tell you, oh, you must be loyal to us, you must be honest with us, But they will shaft you. They'll shaft you in a second. They'll kick you out on your ass without even thinking about it. And now, with the Ukraine war and all the instability in South Africa and the growing instability elsewhere, I must tell you, I think white people are in for a nasty time. And I'm starting to see people who never thought they'd lose their jobs, or people who felt comfortable with their businesses, and now it's over and it's gone and it's done, and they have been driven out or they've lost their businesses. Some of those people have even lost their homes. So people who 5 years ago were feeling quite happy and confident are now battling. And if they're surviving, they're struggling, and some of them might not have made it. There's an Englishman who lives down the road from me, and he's a liberal, but the other day he said to me that if you look at the long-term future, he said to me, we're fucked. So I said to him, yeah, indeed we are. And I've known about it. And it's been bothering me for a long time. But this Englishman who was so keen on liberalism, he's starting to realize that, you know what? Things are going very wrong. Another supporter of mine in South Africa was working in a management position in IT, and he was doing good, but eventually, working with these non-whites and all their nonsense, he eventually actually got himself a job where he just works as a computer programmer, he sits in his corner, and he doesn't get involved in all the other nonsense that used to stress him and drive him crazy. And he said to me, he only goes to work in order to get the cash, and that's all. Beyond that, he doesn't care a fig about his job. And me, in my work, I was like that in the last decade or so. I just went to work just to get the cash, and I didn't care about anything else. I had already, long before that, lost all interest in enjoying my work and doing things to the utmost of my ability. I was sick of the management, sick of the shit, and just milking them for what it's worth. And I did that knowing that at some point they might kick me out. And when they do, I'm going to fight them legally. And that's exactly what happened. They spent about 2 years trying to get rid of me, and I fought them tooth and nail in those 2 years. And I even managed to get two managers to quit. I actually created such a problem for one non-white manager that he resigned and he left. And when they tried to destroy me right at the end, I managed to lay charges against a much higher ranking non-white manager, and they demoted her. So I managed to put the knife into some of them as well, and I fought tooth and nail right to the end, including with a lawyer, and that is how it ended. But I had been aware for a long time that this is probably the best way to do it. So when it came, it didn't bother me. I gave them quite a fight, and I hit back as much as I could inside the system while I could before they eventually could get me out. I made them pay. I made them pay for what they were doing. And I will tell you, some of those managers, the one that quit and the other one that was demoted, they never saw it coming. They never thought that a white guy could land some punches on them. And nowadays in South Africa, the blacks just give contracts to each other. The place is so freaking corrupt that blacks have got all kinds of business deals with each other, and they're giving business to each other flat out. And whites can't get contracts with government, even if the whites can do the job better. is a European woman who lives near me, and she has a nice business. And at a point, she decided she wanted some government contracts. She felt comfortable that she could do this. But in order to get government contracts, you need to give half of your company to some non-white, mostly to blacks. Anyway, she went through the whole rigmarole and she got herself, quotes, certified, so she now had a black partner. And she was looking forward to getting lots of government jobs from this black partner. And so basically, they bring in a black partner. Firstly, you've got to give like a chunk of your business to this black. And secondly, you're just doing it for marketing. So you're hoping that this black can bring in business. Anyway, because her business was not that big, she didn't have to give half of it away. I can't remember the exact arrangement, but still she had to pay extra money and do a whole bunch of stuff in order to be certified. And she told me that it was such a waste of time having this black person and the business, the bit of business that she got later, and that after a time she actually called it quits. She called it quits, she could see this is a waste of time. So she'd gone through all that legal rigmarole and all that kind of stuff and it wasn't working. And places like Eskom, the parastatal like Eskom, they are firing whites and hiring blacks. They hired something like 18,000 blacks in a period of 10 years. But the people they really need are highly technically skilled whites, and they're getting rid of them. They don't care about them. Organizations like AfriForum have gone to them and said to them, listen, here we've got 500 white guys. They've got the perfect skills for you guys. Just hire them and all your load shedding will go away, kind of thing. And of course, these blacks aren't interested. What has really happened in South Africa and what has happened around the world is that white people are the only people who believe in the free market. Meanwhile, blacks and Jews have cornered business in Western countries and they are giving business to their bum chums and working with their personal networks. And everybody's tossing white people out like they're garbage. And in recent years, we've had to sit back and watch companies like Twitter, Facebook, PayPal, and others kick white people in the teeth, shut down the accounts of whites, ban white people, etc. And basically engage in censorship of whites in an area where they actually have no right to be. Those companies do not have the legal backing of the law to engage in censorship, but they're just doing it anyway, and they're destroying whites. Large numbers of whites who used to earn lots of money on YouTube were all tossed out. I was just one of large numbers. There were whites on YouTube with more than 1 million subscribers, and their accounts were just shut down. They were kicked up their asses. So the bottom line is that whites have been kicked around like dogs. Whites have been kicked around like dirt, treated like pieces of shit. And the fact of the matter is, all of us have got high skills. And one thing that I sat and thought to myself about was this. I was thinking, you know, we whites, whether it's us in South Africa or whites in America or Europe, etc., or Canada, that It is us with our skills who helped to build and bring profits to these big, ungrateful corporate scum. The same scum that now hand huge amounts of money to blacks while kicking whites up their asses. Those same banks that are now almost totally black, their computer systems were built by white people. Guys like myself, we went and built their computer systems. Their computer systems are still running and keeping them functioning to this day, the computer systems that were built by whites. But they treat us like dirt, and they kicked people out on their asses and replaced whites with non-whites. I think I've mentioned the story before in the bank of a little department of whites in one segment of the bank, little department of whites who were doing computer work. There were about 10 whites in this little computer department, and they were all replaced. But they were replaced eventually by more than 100 whites and non-whites. They were replaced by more than 100 people. So it's not like they were replacing whites and becoming more efficient. They were replacing whites and becoming more inefficient. There were systems where one white person was doing a certain system, or two white people were doing a certain computer system, and they'd be replaced by a whole team of blacks. So now there's like anything from 5 to 10 blacks doing the same work that one or two whites were doing. And I think that the way things are going, whites are just going to get shafted left, right, and center. So I've been doing some thinking, and I was thinking that all these scum who run these big corporations, these big non-white, anti-white, globalist corporations, they think that they can kick whites around like dogs, and that whites can just be kicked around and thrown around without any respect, and that they are the kings and the lords of the realm. But if it wasn't for our skills, much of what they have wouldn't exist. And I've wondered whether whites shouldn't be fighting back. And the whole secret to fighting back is to work as a team. We have been destroyed by other teams, other groups with their own networks, Jews and blacks and others with their own networks who've been destroying us. Well, why don't we have Team White and we look after each other? I want to show you some videos, because what is in these videos will show you some deeper and more complex problems that are well worth studying. One group of people that I've noticed, by the way, who have not had any problem fighting back against corporations are the Asians. People all across Asia just ignore these corporations and they do their own thing. But these corporations in the West, they treat whites like pieces of dirt, basically like dog shit. And with their high-tech electronics, etc., lots of these companies have thought that they could just kick whites in the teeth and that whites would just be destroyed. And they just do as they please. COVID has probably been one of the best examples of corporate arrogance. But what was good about COVID was COVID really pissed off lots of people. And whites have really fought back on COVID. And I think that the white pushback on COVID was beyond anything that they could imagine. But have you noticed the various inefficiencies and costs that are coming out of these big, dominant global corporate businesses? How wasteful they are while using white technology and science. And they are trying to control people and trying to move in on people. Cars, modern cars, are a joke as far as I'm concerned. But there's a group of people who have been particularly hard hit by corporates. And we're going to take a close look at this group. And that group is farmers in North America. Farming is a tough job, and it's the one place where lots of white men go to, and they feel quite happy taking their chances with nature and doing hard work and even dangerous work. Farming is not for sissies, and yet all over the world you'll find white men take to it like ducks to water. And John Deere, which is basically like the Mercedes-Benz of tractors, John Deere and white American farmers have been getting into a hell of a fight. There are many aspects of America that I like a lot. I really like a lot of things about America. America is built on the Roman Empire, and that model works very well as long as there are enough people of the same kind. So when something affects whites and whites go and fight the system, then things really work. So what has been happening is that John Deere has been building more and more advanced equipment. It's a lot like the cars. And these big, sneaky companies have been working on a plan that they're going to put more and more computers and software and stuff into these expensive machines, but that they are going to control this more and more, and that they're going to use it to get a monopoly. Because one of the things that happens with manufacturing, and I even saw this in software myself, is that if you make something, you might get a certain amount of money for it, but if you have to repair it or make changes to it, you can actually make more money out of that. So what John Deere has been doing is John Deere actually wants all the farmers to come back and have all the repairs done by John Deere. So it will make them a ton of money. And it does make them huge amounts of money. But farmers, and this is a historical thing, white farmers are tough guys. And armies in the past were built on white farmers. If you go back to ancient Greece, Rome, it is white farmers who are toughies, okay? And you can't kick a white farmer around easily. And that is probably why in South Africa the government has been working so hard to destroy white farmers, because they know that those white farmers are going to be the ones that are going to give you the hardest time. Anyhow, these white farmers in America, they are clever, they are innovative, and they're used to fixing their own equipment. And so now, for the first time ever, they are finding that they can't fix their equipment, and that this is becoming a serious problem to them, and it's becoming very expensive. So these farmers are starting to fight back. Now, at the time that I'm making this video, these farmers have not won by any means. They've been fighting for years, but they've been fighting and they're not quitting. But what is really interesting is to watch what is happening between John Deere and the farmers. And this story is so big that at certain state hearings in America, even Microsoft, and all these other companies, like I think Microsoft and Mac and all these companies, quietly sent delegations to go and sit there and listen, because there's a big fight going on and these farmers are hitting back, because these companies thought they could just come and crush the whites, and now these whites are fighting back. So you're going to see farmers hacking into their systems and trying to figure out what is going on. These farmers are trying all kinds of tricks. And so the concept is the right to repair. And this is very fascinating. Now, John Deere is fighting back in a dirty way, like it would, like these corporates are. But this fight that these farmers are fighting has got implications for other things. It's got implications even for phones and computers. And that is why Microsoft and all these other companies are watching this, because if these farmers were to win, this could expand into something else. But the key thing here is to watch these farmers who are no match for these big corporates. But these farmers are standing their ground, even though there aren't that many of them, and they're fighting back like crazy against the corporates. And what I want you to look at is the ingenuity of the whites. Look at the ingenuity of the farmers, and you'll even see in these videos that you'll see some white guys who used to work for the corporates who actually want to help the farmers and have got their own businesses, and they want to try and do these repairs and things for cheaper than these big corporates. So there's a lot of complex technical stuff in here, but watch how the farmers are talking, what they're doing, and what they are thinking. Because they've actually started to push these big corporate bastards back a bit. And I'm absolutely convinced that if all whites stick together and we work together and we use our brains, that we could start destroying these huge companies that are working against us. We can beat these bastards. If enough whites get going and doing various things, whites can become competition for these huge businesses. So this first video that you're going to see is a video from 2 years ago, the status of this battle between the farmers and John Deere 2 years ago.
We're going to hook my laptop up to this combine and try to get codes out of it, I guess.
I would say what I'm doing is hacking.
Farms today use a tremendous amount of technology.
Deermates claims that you only really have the license to use their software. And for someone to say they own the software pretty much takes away the whole viability of the entire tractor or a piece of equipment.
The only person that can repair those tractors to a great extent is the dealership.
I mean, look at the size of this machine. If I had to haul this thing 100 miles every time something went wrong with it, it'd cost a fortune. I mean, just to get it on a truck, it was $1,000. And by the time you get it hauled somewhere and get it hauled back, you're $2,000 into fixing something maybe relatively minor.
What we've had develop is essentially a monopoly on repair.
We live in a disposable society. When our technology breaks, we replace it. But the art of repair is still practiced by a select few in our tech-obsessed culture. Tractors are the workhorses of agriculture. But unlike the past, the tractor of today is a complex computerized system that relies on embedded software to function. While technology has made tractors more efficient, it has made repair nearly impossible for farmers who need access to the software to repair their equipment. We went to Nebraska to meet the people at the forefront of Right to Repair, a movement fighting large tech companies for access to the diagnostic software needed to fix our things.
I am actually the fifth generation farming here on this operation where you sit today. We've been around for a while, since the mid-1800s.
The kids laugh because she's my cat. She follows me around more. The big tractors over here we use for the day-to-day operations in row crop farming. Anything that requires a lot of horsepower, a lot of traction, you know, those are both big issues for us. A smaller tractors like this little guy here, we use for maintenance of the yard. We use them a lot. These little tractors we use a lot in the vegetable operation. This is the tractor that I learned to drive tractor on. One of the things on growing up on a farm that happens is you learn to do everything very young. As soon as I could sit on the very front edge of that seat and push that clutch in, I learned how to drive. And the beauty of that tractor in terms of repair is I can go anywhere and get parts for it. We could tear this thing down and overhaul it in probably a week's time. It's a different era for sure.
The earliest developments were in the engines. And probably from the mid-80s, you know, we started to see computerized components and engines to the point where in the mid-90s, essentially the entire engine is run by the computer. And so now today, all functions of the tractor are run by the computer.
The seat in that tractor over there is more complicated than this entire tractor.
as tractors have become more high-tech, the repairs have become more challenging. We do not have the ability to hook up a computer to a tractor to diagnose it, to repair it, or even to activate components that we may buy to put on that tractor, particularly with older tractors. We would buy used parts and put on them to save money. And today, I can go out, and there are used parts for these tractors, these newer tractors that are available. But if I put them on, the tractor won't run.
This receiver is, for the most part, a perfectly functioning receiver, okay? What this does is it receives satellite signals from GPS satellites. TCM in this is broken, okay? It's not functioning. What we were told by Deere is, well, we don't support this anymore. So essentially what they did was they forced us to buy a new unit because they won't support this anymore and we can't get the repairs for it.
This is actually my house, really. I work from a home, I guess you call it, but I got buildings I put up around here just so I could, you know, work from home. This is my latest project I worked on. It's we call it the Luda Crusher, but it's a monster truck I built. My business is Ludicky Diesel. Basically, I have a repair shop, and what I do is pretty much mostly is just to repair John Deere equipment, just because I used to work in the John Deere dealership for 23 years, and all the customers know me, so they come in, and it's been great. If, say, it was actually a computer fault where the computer itself was damaged or whatnot, or stopped communicating and had to replace it, I could physically replace the computer, but the computers come basically brain dead, so you have to have software from John Deere for the serial number tractor. My biggest situation that I can't fix everything, you know, every situation now is, you know, because I don't have, you know, John Deere's service advisor laptop. You know, I can't connect to the equipment. I'm pretty restricted on what I can do as far as the newer equipment.
One of the things I've been told some guys are doing to deal with these issues is there's pirated software out there from Eastern Europe that guys are utilizing to try to get around this to be able to work on their tractors themselves.
I believe the software I got's a hacked version of John Deere's system when it comes to tractors. I mean, I farm, so out of necessity, they break down and I have to repair them in one way or another, and it's a lot cheaper to do it myself than it is to haul it into a repair shop or a dealer to have it fixed.
We got lots of, I mean, everywhere on a combine, there's a sensor here and a sensor there, and every single little part of it has a electrical sensor in it. A couple of years ago, we were doing custom anhydrous as fertilizer on cornfields, and you have a real small window to be able to get this done in the year, and the tractor broke down. So I had to find this software to be able to repair my tractor and make my customer happy and make a living. There's a whole selection of the machines based on serial numbers and what they are. And you got to pick the one out that's the right serial number for this machine. And then you'll be able to come over here. Once you're able to get into this, you know, I can go in and I can do a diagnostic on it, and it'll start checking all the codes and looking for what I have wrong. And then I can go up here and I can look at them and see what the problem is and why it's popping up.
In 2015, the Library of Congress granted an exemption to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that makes it legal for farmers to hack their tractors for the purposes of repair. But software modification is still against John Deere's terms of service, which were updated soon after the ruling. Despite this, Right to Repair is a growing movement that's turning ordinary farmers like Guy Mills into activists.
I wrote an op-ed in the paper after I researched the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. I talked to some other people and other farmers after I wrote this op-ed, and they said, hey, we really like what you said. So I said, you know, maybe we should do something about this. So I made a resolution for our local Nebraska corn growers, and I said, let's put something in our bylaws there that we support a right to repair. And who could argue with that? Then Lydia Brosh, and I must commend her, she'd come in with LB 67.
I am six names down.
The Fair Repair Act gives an individual the ability, you've always had the right, but the ability to purchase the diagnostic tools and to take it somewhere local or to try to repair the equipment yourself.
Apple and Microsoft showed up at the hearing in Lincoln. Why would Apple care about whether a farmer from Nebraska works on his tractor?
LB 67 got the attention of big tech companies because it affects the repair of all electronics, including smartphones, computers, and of course, tractors.
Again, the way the bill is drafted, it says that any product that is sold and used in the state of Nebraska. If I'm the big guy, what I do is I just don't sell my products in the state of Nebraska because they have to be sold here. If it's online, I don't sell to anybody who has a zip code in Nebraska. And if I'm a little manufacturer, I move out of the state of Nebraska.
You get lobbyists on occasion, but never has anyone flown in to discourage me from introducing a bill. And their points, I believe, were not valid. I don't believe it's valid that this would open a mecca for hackers. They stated their case. They were doing their job. And I believe I'm doing my job in protecting constituents and helping them, you know, to be able to grow economies in our local towns.
If the bill passes, I can go buy this cable instead of building my own, and I would be able to just hook into the data port and be able to get all the information that I need right there. I wouldn't have to improvise and build my own stuff to be able to see what's going on.
LB 67, or the Fair Repair Act, is still being held by the Nebraska State Legislature. As of the beginning of 2018, 12 states are considering similar bills. John Deere declined our request to visit Nebraska dealerships, but they gave us a statement regarding right to repair.
When I see the implement dealers, and you do see them, they're people on your main street, you know, you don't wish them any ill. You know, you wish them success. You want them to continue to serve the community. And I think they can do that as they access or give you access to the technology of the diagnostics. It's just the diagnostics, folks.
It's really interesting. These older tractors are still capable of going out and doing a day's work. And I wonder, with all the technology we have in the newer tractors, if the same will be true of them when they're that same age.
So that video that you saw was from 2 years ago, and the whole core of the thing is the right to repair. In this video, we're going to look at these farmers, but there's a lot more than just things like this, like right to repair, that I'm going to discuss. But for now, we're going to focus on all these issues around this big company, John Deere, and this fight with the farmers, because this is just part of a much bigger thing. Interestingly enough, that farmer who showed that tiny tractor that he drove when he was young, I learned to drive a small tractor in Rhodesia when I was 9 years old. So from the age of 9 years onwards, I was driving tractors. I think I learned how to drive my dad's pickup truck by the time I was about 12, I think I was big enough to actually sit in the pickup truck and control it. And then I'd go and drive from the house to the road to go and collect the milk cans, because we had dairy cattle, and every day you'd have to put out your milk by the road, and then a truck would come, pick it up, take it to the dairy marketing board, and then later in the day it would drop off all the empty cans. That's the cool thing about farming, is that boys are exposed to all kinds of different things. It's different to people who grow up in apartments, etc. I'm not saying that everybody should grow up on a farm, but I do think that boys and even girls would benefit by spending some time on farms when they grow up. So anyway, returning to the farmers, these people in Nebraska are pushing for access to this diagnostic software. Now, John Deere, by using all that computerized stuff, John Deere has got tremendous control over that equipment. I was reading that in the Ukraine war, that apparently the Russians grabbed some John Deere equipment in Ukraine, and they say that John Deere in America was able to switch off that equipment remotely. That is a whole other topic where military stuff is even wilder than this. But white technology and software is very powerful, and they can control all kinds of things. So these farmers can't even get into their machines to even find out what the problem is. So they want diagnostic software. And the other thing is, the software is so potent that they can't just go and buy any kind of second-hand part or whatever, because the software, the computers, will switch it off and will reject it. So notice how they are saying that some software is pirated in Eastern Europe and they buy it from there. But also at that hearing, at the state level for John Deere, Apple and Microsoft sent people there because this affects more than just tractors. This could become a thing for phones, any kind of highly technical piece of equipment. And that farmer was saying, look at those old tractors. They are old and strong and still able to function decades later. And as a kid in Rhodesia, when we were getting farm equipment, we also used lots of American stuff. We had Ford tractors, Massey Ferguson, etc. Massey Ferguson was very popular. Only a few people could afford things like John Deere. But Massey Ferguson was very popular, and we were using equipment that was 20 or 30 years old. Our stuff was old by American standards, and we were using 20-year-old tractors, reconditioning them, and they were functioning fine for us. Meanwhile, across the border, the blacks were getting brand new equipment, and their stuff was breaking and standing in the fields. But anyway, this farmer is saying, look at these old tractors. They can still go out and do a day's worth of work. They might not be as fancy, and they might not be as productive as the new tractors. But he poses a question, and he says, will the newer tractors last as long as those older tractors? And he doesn't think so. This brings me back to junk capitalism. You see a lot of it in cars. Cars are filled with junk capitalism as well, where you've got all these fancy doodads, but that vehicle isn't going to last long, and it's got all kinds of weird problems and all kinds of expenses, and that was designed into it because those companies are trying to control you. The next video is also short, but this video is from a year ago, and you'll hear the progress that's made, and you'll see some other things in that video.
Farming in America could not exist without John Deere.
I don't care where you are. In the rural parts of America, there's farmland, and you're inevitably going to see green tractors.
Specifically in the Midwest, where people who've had Deere machines for generations say that their family bleed green. It's really to that extent.
But John Deere's tractors aren't the only thing bleeding green. John Deere is on pace to have its most profitable year ever.
John Deere is forecast to make about $7.7 billion in their fiscal year 2021. That would be a record.
But while John Deere shareholders and executives could not be happier, John Deere has been in a battle on two fronts. Between a massive union strike from upset workers and a legal battle with farmers concerning equipment repairs called Right to Repair, John Deere must convince their customers and their employees that they care about more than just profits. This is The Breakdown.
There's a saying that you'll hear either Deere say or other people say, if farmers are profiting, Deere's profiting. And Deere wants to do everything they can to make those farmers a lot more profitable.
Since the pandemic hit in 2020 and millions of Americans sheltered in place buying nothing but groceries, both John Deere and farmers became even more essential in feeding America, and both profited a great deal as a result.
Because the machines that they make are essential to an industry that has to provide an essential product for consumers, not only in the United States, but across the globe.
John Deere's profits during the pandemic are eye-popping, and that wealth has spread out to executives like CEO John May, who brought in $15.6 million in 2020, a 160% raise.
And according to our Bloomberg data, he's going to make about $30 million for the 2021 fiscal year. So you're talking about almost $10 million more for the CEO earnings.
Shareholders also saw their slice of the pie, in part because of John Deere's stock buybacks. Buybacks are a piece of financial engineering by a company to repurchase shares of its own stock to reduce the number of shares in the market, which in turn increases the ownership stake for the shareholders.
The stock buybacks for them have been significant. So in the past 12 months, they bought back $1.9 billion in stock, and they bought back $716 million alone in their fiscal third quarter of 2021.
One group who thought they were not sharing in that wealth? John Deere factory workers.
So the optics are obviously looking bad for the company now that a labor strike has broken out among part of their workforce.
During this boom time, Deere offered their workers a 5% pay increase. That's when over 10,000 United Auto workers who worked for John Deere went on strike.
I had one person in particular say, our CEO is about to make $10 million more for this year than he did last year. The company is seeing earnings go to records. The stock price is surging. And yet we're the group who, during the past recession and past down economic cycles in the farming industry, we took cuts.
After the union turned down two contracts, John Deere was finally able to meet their demands in late November, which doubled raises and improved pensions for union members.
Those employees that are represented by the UAW are immensely valuable employees to us. We're super proud of where the contract ended up. It's groundbreaking in a lot of ways, both from near-term wage increases as well as the retirement medical benefits that it offers. It's super helpful to understand how the work is done in the factories, what the opportunities are to make improvements for whatever the operation happens to be, to make the lives of those that are doing that work better.
So while John Deere workers fought and won their battle to see the profits the company has brought in over the past 2 years, farmers are still in their own fight with Deere when it comes to repairing their own equipment.
So a lot of farms our size use a variety of technology. We use old technology, we use new technology. My name is Tom Brandt, and you are currently in Plymouth, Nebraska. I am a farmer and also a state senator. I represent District 32, Fillmore Thayer, Jefferson, Saline, and southwestern Lancaster counties here in Nebraska. The state of Nebraska's agriculture is the fourth largest ag powerhouse in the nation. We feed way more people with the food we produce than just the 1.96 million people here in the state of Nebraska. The farm that you're on today is a farm that's common to southeast Nebraska. We rotate corn and soybeans. It takes hundreds of thousands of dollars to operate a small farm like this. Our margins are razor thin. Farming is an industry where we buy retail and we sell wholesale.
While the principles of farming remain the same, the equipment used to farm has changed dramatically.
This is a 1952 Alice Chalmers WD. This is a style of tractor I grew up on in the 60s and 70s. This tractor has not started for 2 months. It's tough and it works. And this is what American farm equipment used to be like.
Farming equipment from both John Deere and their major competitors has become much more technologically sophisticated in the past two decades.
A little after 2000, tractors changed from being strictly just a power and source and got to be a lot more computerized. Now they're all basically drive-by-wire systems where there's no physical connection between any of our controls and the tractor except a piece of wire. And every generation tractor since is even more computerized.
It surprises people every day how technologically sophisticated the equipment is, whether that's, you know, GNSS satellite guidance in our equipment, or whether it's the digital information that comes off those equipment that helps make customers enable them to make better decisions every day.
This is the main computer screen right here. It can show us moisture, it can show us yield, it can show us the various components on the combine. 20 years ago, our irrigated corn probably yielded 150-60 bushels to the acre. This last crop we just harvested, we did 250 bushels to the acre. So if your crops are gaining yield 40% over 10 or 20 years, you're going to need bigger, faster equipment to harvest it.
And those bigger, faster machines have increased productivity an estimated 1.4% per year over the past 70 years. And U.S. farmers now produce an average corn yield of about 175 bushels an acre.
And then the really valuable information that starts to move markets is what the harvest looks like. So now one of these enormous harvesters will tell in real time through this modem under the farmer's rear end back to Deere and who knows where, to Goldman Sachs maybe, exactly how much corn or wheat is being harvested on that farm acreage at that moment. It's really staggering.
We can get a lot more done in a day. We can work longer hours. Especially with auto steer, auto guidance systems, we can get a lot more hours in. We're not tired at the end of the day. So the efficiency factor is great when it works. And unfortunately, like all electronics, it doesn't always work.
And that's where there's a catch. While the technology in a John Deere tractor or combine makes farming easier than ever before, there are very real concerns from some farmers when it comes to repairing that equipment because as of right now, they can't. John Deere and other agricultural machinery companies won't let farmers fix their own equipment without a licensed mechanic. For Deere and its dealerships, parts and services are 3 to 6 times more profitable than sales of original equipment, according to company filings.
Historically, farmers have always repaired their own equipment.
Farmers love to tinker. I will grant that. We all like to tinker with our equipment, and we all modify our equipment. The right to repair gets down to the nuts and bolts that currently farmers don't have access to the computer systems on their farm equipment. Doesn't matter whether it's green John Deere or it's red Case or AGCO's. They're all proprietary. They won't let us in on that.
The thing that you fix on the tractor isn't necessarily like a moving part. It may be something that has to be fixed in the software or like hitting a reset button for your computer.
We've had a few cases where we get an error code on the panel and it is basically, you look it up and it says, call your dealer. So the dealer has to come out and they plug their computer into the tractor and they have to diagnose what the problem is.
We have operators who have had computer glitches during planting. They have a newer tractor, they have a newer planter. It happens on a Friday. They got to wait till Monday to get it fixed. They've lost 2.5 days. If they were given access to the operating system, they knew what they had to do to repair that.
And there are literally billions of dollars at stake for John Deere when it comes to repairs.
They make a lot of their money in the dealerships from parts and repair because, frankly, they have a monopoly. And that monopoly has been significantly enhanced by the software controls in the modern tractor. No one else can work on them.
Annual parts sales increased 23% to $6.8 billion from 2013 to 2020, while Deere's total agricultural equipment sales fell 20% to $22.3 billion. So there's very real money at stake when it comes to repair. If a right to repair law allowed parts and services markets to compete, it could be a huge blow to a vital income stream for the company.
The farmers of the world say, we've been repairing these things forever. Farmers know how to fix things, know how to keep things working in the fields. And by denying us that, you're essentially taking away a kind of birthright.
John Deere is also the target of a potential federal class action lawsuit alleging antitrust violations tied to its repair policies. John Deere declined to comment on the litigation, but said it meets company commitments to provide parts, information, and software to owners of its equipment. However, there is precedent when it comes to right to repair.
The best way of explaining the right to repair is to go back to automobiles. As automobiles were built with more and more software and chips, it became more and more difficult for the average car owner to fix their car. Because the software, you didn't have the tools to do that.
So in 2012, the state of Massachusetts introduced a right to repair bill on light cars and trucks. They were the only state in the nation to do that. And what that did is that opened the floodgates and made it possible for third-party mechanics, the mom and pop, to access and repair all those vehicles. I can tell you locally, we have a situation just like that. Last January of 2021, based on the fact that the Farm Bureau membership overwhelmingly wanted to see a right to repair bill, we introduced one.
That bill, called LB 543, was voted in favor 176-1 by the farmers. Yet right now that bill sits in committee because it required amendments to only reference repairing farm equipment and not other electronics like iPhones, computers, and televisions.
Our position's fairly straightforward. We believe that farmers have the right to repair their equipment. Where we draw the line is the right to modify, and it generally involves the embedded software that we put on the machines. Agricultural equipment is less like consumer electronics than it is really like aviation, right? You wouldn't want just anybody fixing and repairing software on an airplane because there is a safety component to it. In the same way, you know, I think a tractor going down the highway is a fairly comparable situation. That's really where our efforts are best spent, to try to make sure that people understand the ramifications and the risks associated with the conversations that are currently happening in the space.
While farmers are waiting for a ruling to be made on right to repair, some are taking matters into their own hands by using gray market technology to run diagnostics on their own equipment.
When you rebel against the technological barrier, you hack it. And there are a number of farmers who've availed themselves of John Deere repair and diagnostic software from places like Hong Kong and other markets where things are sold without the proper licenses. It's the software black market, or in this case, it's really a gray market.
Right now, the right to repair is still moving forward. But its future is anything but certain.
Currently, LB 543 is sitting in committee, and we chose to have it stay there for 1 year to allow all parties to give us some input on this. and it's pretty much been crickets. But the hue and cry out here in the country is getting louder. People want more regulation, or at least the opportunity to control their own destiny. They don't like seeing it in the hands of big corporations.
We'll keep working at it until we get it accomplished. I'm not afraid of a fight. I haven't met a farmer yet that's not afraid of a fight. So we'll state our piece and see what we can get done.
The tractors and the farming equipment produced by John Deere and these other companies, I've also seen what the German companies are producing and European companies are producing. It's absolutely amazing. It is just fantastic stuff. But what I don't like, and I've learned to hate it, is the way that these companies try to crush white people. And that is where I draw the line. They're basically trying to kick people in the teeth, and they just care about their profits, etc. There is the CEO who's going to be taking home $30 million himself. When I was younger, I used to look up to all these kinds of people. I used to look at all these people who earn huge salaries and become very rich, and I used to think that's a good thing. They are talented people, etc. But as time has gone by, I no longer look at it that way. I have a much more jaundiced view of economics. And I've worked in corporations and I've seen what corporations can do. Anyhow, this technology is so incredible, and the technology has been making American farms insanely productive, and it's all due to the white race's technology, due to electronics and computers and stuff. As I said in the previous commentary about the previous video, that John Deere can switch off equipment, can turn it off even if it's on the other side of the world. Well, here you can see that these vehicles can talk directly to John Deere's computer systems and can feed to them the corn yield as the harvester is busy harvesting the corn. And as that guy says, you know, those figures could perhaps even be going straight to Goldman Sachs through their computer systems. Now, as a computer programmer myself, all of those things that those people are saying is true. All these big corporations, whether it's in South Africa or elsewhere, and with governments, you've got huge computer systems that are busy pumping data in real time from the one to the other. When it gets to the Western military systems and government systems, it's unbelievable what is actually taking place. So it is correct. Yes, you can have that harvester that is harvesting there, and it can be telling your profitability and your corn yields, not just to John Deere, but to anybody else that John Deere might want to pass it on to. And yes, it's fantastic technology, but now you're seeing these people who've bought these pieces of equipment getting kicked in the teeth, and the big company is trying to crush them down. And yeah, some of that technology is just beyond imagination. The ability to auto-steer, auto-guidance, etc. Farmers can work longer hours into the night. Really, it is... white civilization at its finest. It's fantastic. But when you try to crush the very people that are buying and working the stuff, that to me is when the gloves need to come off and whites need to fight back. So John Deere is using all this complex technology, computer software, electronics, etc., to basically get a monopoly on the repairs of their equipment. And they're basically using computer systems to actually shut down and control the physical piece of equipment that you've bought. So that is where these people are abusing technology. And rest assured, there's a lot of Jewish ideas and things that must be all part and parcel of this. Jews coming and consulting with the companies or getting them to come up with all these wild schemes. That's why I don't trust these big businesses. They are ruthless, they're vicious, and they do destroy people. And they may even have agendas to destroy people. And in this case, these farmers are battling. But it turns out that related to this whole business are the cars, the car market. And that in 2012, in the state of Massachusetts, the state actually forced this concept of the right to repair on car manufacturers because there are more cars on the market, and eventually the guys who were fixing cars were fighting back and they had the numbers. But this is a great lesson in the incredible sophistication of what is possible for whites. But when whites lose control of these companies, and these companies are on a mission of their own that have got absolutely nothing to do with the common person. The next video is a short video. It's 5 minutes long, and it's actually from an American guy who's a car dealer and he repairs cars, and he's actually got an amazingly large following. And he comments on this whole issue of these tractors. And I love his comments. He says, this is un-American. This needs to be stopped. People should stop buying John Deere, etc. But the way that he also describes the way that the corporate businesses like John Deere, the way that they treat the people, they've got lawyers, they've got lots of money, and they don't want to let the state and the government get involved. So instead what they choose is to lie to the farmers and stuff them around. It's actually a great piece of commentary. And then we'll head off into other areas that we need to look at. Because I want to discuss how white business can smash all these other businesses that are coming out here and they think they can just take people and just kick them in the teeth just because they're run by billionaires. People have made billions. Now they think they can come and kick everyone in the face and smash everyone down. But there are ways of fighting back. That's what I want to discuss. There are ways also for whites to have greater profit than these disgusting global anti-white, anti-Western freaking companies that now think that they are some kind of law unto themselves and that they can kick normal people around by the millions, by the tens or hundreds of millions and do the hell what they please. And we've seen that with Facebook and PayPal and Jew-related stuff where the whole goal is to come and terrorize and smash the common person, to the detriment not only of the common person, but the country and civilization, actually. Anyway, here's the car guy. He's freaking awesome.
What do you think you're getting ripped off if you get your car fixed at the dealer? Guess what? The tractor owners do too. It turns out that a few years ago, John Deere promised the farmers that it would make tractors easier to repair and they could get all the information. The reason they said that was because they were trying to get the Right to Repair Act, just like they recently passed in Massachusetts, so that private mechanics can get all the information and you as an owner can get the information to have your car fixed, and the dealers can't hide all that information. They actually passed the bill there. Well, the John Deere tractor manufacturers, they all decided, hey, we don't want to have that right to repair bill for the farmers passed, so well, don't worry, we'll give you that information. Well, guess what? They vowed that by January 1st, 2021, that Deere would make repair tools, software, and diagnostics available to the masses. But they haven't. They just lied. This is why these have to be forced. These companies have to be forced to do it because they'll promise they'll do something, then they don't. Well, we promise promised. Well, you know, promises can be broken. And it got so bad that some of the John Deere tractor owners, they were fixing the software that was hacked from the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians got the software and cracked it. I mean, that's been going on for ages in the automotive industry, too. When a company like Mercedes, they want you to buy one of their $20,000 up scan tools to work on their cars. Well, the Chinese would just reverse engineer them and sold them to the world. Nobody's even going to care one way or another with that. I had bought one of those years ago from an American company. It was a tool company, and I bought the scan tool from the American tool company, paid the tax and everything on it. It's made in China, but it was sold in the United States to an American tool company, and I used it to work on Mercedes-Benzes because I was going to spend $25,000 for that fancy machine. And I got the information. It only cost me like $1,800 to buy the machine. And the farmers were doing the same thing. They were getting it from the Ukrainians. And of course, John Deere whined about it, and they said they were going to give the information out, but they didn't. Now, the farmers have been waiting 3 years, and to quote the farmers, we waited for this information, and now we see. It's not even a half measure. You can't get this information. And of course, these companies, in this case John Deere, they come up with the lamest of excuses. Here's their quote. We can't allow farmers to access the computer system at this level because it's a security risk. Okay, come on now. We've heard that enough from the government. You can't learn that. That's a security risk. That's top secret. What a load of baloney. These are farmers that are trying to farm and get us food, right? And they're being ripped off by the company who says, well, we're the only ones that have the information to fix it. Now, of course, the farm machinery is even worse than cars. One of these farm implements has 136 of these separate modules in it. 136. That's even worse than a Mercedes-Benz. Just, you know, another thing of greed, and the company's lying to people. Said, oh yeah, we will in 3 years. 3 years later, they haven't. And now they say, oh, it's a security risk, you know. It is just absurd when they get involved in this stuff. And the poor farmers, they're stuck in the middle. There was one guy that he couldn't fix it himself, so he had to tow the thing to John Deere. And he said, well, now they only charged me $800 to fix it, but it was just a sensor that wasn't that hard to replace. He could have easily replaced himself if he knew what it was, but the time that he lost bringing it back and forth, he said it really cost him $8,000 for the lost time that he used harvesting and planting, whatever he was using it for, right? Time is money in any kind of business. So it's just, you know, another symptom of greedy companies ripping everybody off, and then they have lawyers hiding behind the scenes saying, well, that's a security risk. We can't give you that information. I thought the farmers would have it better than we do, but no, they're even worse. They have more sensors, and the companies won't get their information out. And it's not like there's that many farmers to complain. If millions of us as consumers complain to the manufacturers and the politicians, as they are, since they're just like wheat in the field, when the wind blows, they bend. If people complain enough, they'll bend, and they'll pass these right-to-repair laws. The farmers don't have enough power because there aren't enough of them. So they get ripped off by the people who build the machines.
Anyway, wasn't that commentary by that American car guy awesome? And I really love the practical side of white Americans. White Americans have got a lovely practical side, but all whites are practical. However, the American system is very interesting, and I like it. It's a no-nonsense kind of thing, and I imagine that it must have been so nice before Jews came with all their naughty, weird, creepy shit. So let's start talking about various solutions to, firstly, this kind of problem, but also to other problems, to how do whites actually defeat these big businesses? Are there tactics and strategies to defeat them? So enter my world, the world of, well, I wasn't sure whether it's the world of geeks and nerds. I actually thought geeks and nerds were the same thing. But now it seems to me that they aren't. And I have a suspicion that some of the definitions of geek and nerd do seem to me to be interchangeable. However, according to this chart, I definitely am a nerd. I much prefer the way the nerds dress, definitely. Geeks are too casual, too slack. I think it will be easier to turn nerds into Nazis. They're already looking pretty neat, if you ask me. But on a serious note, yes, let's enter this world of the nerds. I'm going to show you how nerds regularly take on powerful people. A long time ago, I did a video where I spoke about how white labor needs to fight Jewish capital, that it's going to boil down to a clash between white labor and Jewish capital. And I'm going to show you this in action. Now, in the case of the Nazis, who are National Socialists, labor is very important. But it's not just any labor either. If you really use your brain and you really use your skills and you think hard and you think cleverly and you work hard, you can definitely achieve something. Now let's take a guy like Bill Gates. Bill Gates is a nerd who went and started doing computer stuff, coming up with the personal computer, and he became a multi-billionaire by creating Microsoft. However, while most whites are aware of names like IBM or Microsoft or Mac, there is another name, and it is from a very different stable, and that is Linux. Linux is probably the best creation that I can think of, which is a case of white labor. In this case, if you actually look more closely at it, it is not only white labor, but it is actually National Socialism as well. Because what you got here is you've got somebody who creates something purely out of their own work, and this person creates something that's totally free. And then other white people come along and they take that thing that is totally free and they keep adding to it, modifying it, improving it, spreading it. So the story of Linux is really the story of labor and a type of National Socialism, type of Nazism, because the product that they're creating is, for most intents and purposes, free. So it functions completely differently to Microsoft and Windows and Mac and iPhone, etc. The way that it is brought into this world is not to do with business. It is not to do with corporate profits. It is something different. It is not a normal business. However, what happens to it and the impact it has on the world is enormous. If you aren't familiar with computers and this name Linux doesn't mean much to you, don't worry about it. You're about to find out. So Linux is an operating system, and Linux is an operating system that is extremely popular for servers, and so Linux runs the vast majority of the internet. Linux runs the vast majority of all cloud computing on the internet, and you'll see that chances are you don't know it, but your phone might actually be running a form of Linux. So here is a 10-minute video that's going to show you how Linux started. It was a white guy in Finland who came up with an idea to create a free operating system, and how he did it, and then how this thing took off. And this thing has literally destroyed the kind of edge that a guy like Bill Gates thought he would have. A guy like Bill Gates thought that he would be able to control you through the business. That he would be able to dictate to you as the owner of Windows. Well, then came Linux. And Linux has broken the ability of Windows and Mac to just do as they please. And huge numbers of people have used Linux. It's just not common for the normal person to use it. But you'll be able to see the power of this thing. So let me explain how the nerds work. The nerds will do something like this Linus guy, Linus Torvald. And he will go and he'll write some software. In this case, he wrote the kernel or the center of an operating system. But then along come other nerds, and they also start taking it and they start working on it. And they start adding to it and improving it. The whole story of Linux is an operating system created by thousands and thousands of whites who are working for free. And they end up creating something that's huge, that nobody can control, and it's unstoppable. And a key concept in creating this software is the concept of what is called open source. Open source means that it is not owned by a particular company. It means that anyone who has the interest can go and look inside of it and can check it and can see what it is and what it does. So this is something that is available to everybody, and those who wish to look at it, check it, modify it, etc., they can do all those things. So it also means that there isn't hidden stuff, that nobody could have gone and hidden nasty things in there, because other nerds coming and looking around would find such things. So everyone can check it, it's open for all to see, and it means that it's not proprietary. It's not secret, and it hasn't got hidden weird things in it. So open source is an enormously powerful concept. And I know that in Europe especially, lots of people moved to Linux just in order to get away from Microsoft. So you could say that open source is like democracy for nerds. So here's a 10-minute video. Watch it, because we're going to talk more, and you'll get a grasp for the scale of Linux and all the things that have come from Linux.
From a hobby project in 1991 to one of the most widely used operating systems in the world, the development of Linux is a remarkable story of collaboration, innovation, and open source software. Linux, for those that don't know, is a community of open source operating systems developed on top of the Linux kernel, the core of the operating system, responsible for managing resources, providing access to hardware, and communicating with other software. One could say it all started in 1991 when Linus Torvalds, a computer science student at the University of Helsinki, started working on the operating system as a hobby project. He was frustrated with the proprietary nature of existing operating systems and wanted to create a free and open source alternative that anyone could use and contribute to. A kernel that could be independent of any OS and be used on his hardware, the new Intel 8386 microprocessor. But it began 22 years earlier. with the invention and implementation of the Unix OS by Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie in 1969 after AT&T had dropped out of the Multics project. The first version was released in 1970, 2 years later rewriting Unix in a new programming language, C, to make it portable. Then, in 1983, Richard Stallman started the GNU project with the goal of creating a free Unix-like operating system, and as a part of his work, wrote the GNU GPL, both very important pieces for the future of Linux. And in 1987, Minix was developed by Andrew S. Tannenbaum as a teaching tool for computer science students. The operating system intended for academic use was small and simple, but restricted modification and redistribution, and wasn't powerful enough to serve as a full-fledged operating system for desktop computers, because it had a 16-bit architecture that wasn't well adapted to Intel's increasingly popular 386 design for PCs, the microprocessor Linux was using at the time. Minix couldn't accomplish what Linus wanted it to do. So on August 25th, 1991, he posted a message to the comp.os.minix newsgroup announcing his new project. He wrote, "I'm doing a free operating system. Just a hobby, won't be big and professional like GNU for 386, 486, AT clones. This has been brewing since April and is starting to get ready." This message marked the beginning of the development of what we all know and love as Linux. A project that never would have existed, according to Linus Torvalds himself, if either the 386 BSD, which was thwarted by AT&T's lawsuit against BSD, since AT&T owned the Unix copyrights, or GNU Herd, thwarted by the lack of development effort, was available at the time, because he wouldn't have been interested in writing his own project. But luckily for us, he did. Torvalds started with a task switcher, an Intel 8386 assembly language, and a terminal driver. Then, as Torvalds wrote in his book, Just for Fun, which I linked in the description, he eventually ended up writing an operating system kernel, the Linux kernel, first made public on September 17th, 1991, where Torvalds released the 10,239 lines of source code for the operating system on the internet and invited other developers to contribute to the project. Over time, the Linux community grew, and thousands of developers from around the world contributed code, bug fixes, and new features to the project. This approach to development, open source development, is one of the key factors that has contributed to the success of Linux. And at this point in the video, I'm sure a handful of people commented down below, "It's not Linux, it's GNU Linux." It's a bit more nuanced than that. The Linux kernel is just Linux. But what most people refer to as Linux today, the distributions, is GNU with Linux added, or GNU Linux. GNU played an incredibly important role in the development of Linux as we know it. As a matter of fact, in the Notes for Linux Release 0.01, Torvalds lists the GNU software that is required to run Linux. Sadly, a kernel by itself gets you nowhere. To get a working system, you need a shell, compilers, a library, etc. These are separate parts and may be under a stricter or even looser copyright. Most of the tools used with Linux are GNU software and are under the GNU copyleft. These tools aren't in the distribution. Ask me or GNU for more info. Although I do think a binary of GNU's bash shell actually was, just saying. In 1992, Torvalds suggested releasing the kernel under the GNU General Public License instead of its very own license it had been using, and did so that December. Linux and GNU developers worked to integrate GNU components with Linux to make a fully functional and free operating system. Torvalds has stated, "Making Linux GPL'd," referring to the GNU GPL, "was definitely the best thing I ever did." So while the designation Linux is initially used by Torvalds only for the Linux kernel, what most of us know as Linux today actually uses a combination of both GNU and Linux and would more appropriately be called GNU Linux, which is what's preferred over what the creator of GNU, Richard Stallman, had initially called the combination Linux, spelled L-I-G-N-U-X, when he published the Emacs 19.31 editor in May of 1996. I think GNU Linux has a slightly nicer ring to it. The story behind the name Linux itself is actually an interesting one. It's obviously derived from the name of its creator, Linus Torvalds, and Unix. But before that, Linus wanted to call it Freaks, as in free Freak, because only a freak would use an operating system built by nobody, and X from Unix, which is the name he used for about half a year because he thought Linux was too egotistical. That is until the files were uploaded to the FTP server of FUNET in September 1991, and Ari Limke of Helsinki University of Technology, a volunteer administrator for the FTP server at the time, named the project Linux on the server without consulting Torvalds, because he did not think Freaks was a good name. I'm inclined to agree with him on that one. Later, however, Torvalds eventually consented to Linux. Oh, and the penguin mascot, the one we all know and love. Its name is Tux, created by Larry Ewing in 1996 after Torvalds mentioned he was bitten by a little penguin on a visit to the National Zoo and Aquarium in Canberra, Australia, with the name deriving from Torvalds Unix, T-U-X, plus it being short for tuxedo. Absolutely iconic. And finally, on Pi Day, nonetheless, March 14th, 1994, Linux kernel 1.0.0 was released. It had received contributions from nearly 12,000 programmers from more than 1,200 companies and consisted of 176,250 lines of code. Quite the increase from the original 10,239. Completely free and completely open source, which seems normal for today, but to get a similar Unix operating system at the time, you'd be shelling out hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. Throughout the years, a number of important Linux distributions were released that have had a significant impact on the growth and development of Linux. Some of the most important distributions include Red Hat, Fedora, Debian, Ubuntu, CentOS, and I gotta mention Arch. Red Hat was one of the first commercially successful Linux distributions and was released in 1994, designed to be a stable and reliable operating system for enterprise use and quickly gained a reputation for quality and reliability. Fedora, released in 2003, is a community-driven distribution that is designed to be a leading-edge platform for the development of new technology. Debian, another community-driven distribution, but released earlier in 1996, has a strong focus on software freedom and is widely used as a base for other distributions. Ubuntu, one of the most popular Linux distributions released in 2004, is designed to be easy to use and accessible to people of all skill levels. CentOS, released in 2004 as well, and also a community-driven distribution like many of these are, was designed to be a stable and reliable platform for enterprise use. And Arch, released in 2002, focuses on a user-centric approach and highly customizable system that's always up to date. It's inspired other distributions to adopt a rolling release model and focus on user control and customization. I also just wanted to tell you that I use Arch, by the way. I've made an entire video in the past about the best Linux distros depending on what you need. In case you wanted to check that out, I'll link it in the description, as well as one about why Linux is better than Windows. Today, Linux is one of the most widely used operating systems in the world and is used by individuals, businesses, and governments alike. As of February 2023, its GitHub repository has roughly 30 million lines of code, 1.1 million commits, and almost 14,000 contributors. There are over 600 active Linux distributions. Linux runs on all of the top 500 fastest supercomputers, 85% of smartphones in the form of Android, 96.3% of the top 1 million web servers, 47% of professional developers use Linux-based or Unix-like operating systems. And as of 2017, I couldn't find anything more recent, about 90% of cloud infrastructure operates on Linux. SpaceX has used Linux-supported systems to complete 65 missions so far, including the famous Falcon 9 missions, and about 90% of Hollywood special effects rely on Linux. This growth and adoption is due in part to the efforts of numerous communities, companies, and organizations that have worked to develop, refine, and support Linux, as well as its adherence to open source principles and the contributions of millions of users around the world. All started by one man who just wanted to get the most out of his 386 clone, but didn't have enough money to do so. You can truly see the impact that Linux and Linus have had on the world. It serves as another reminder, as with Alan Turing, that one person, one project, can truly make a difference. I hope you enjoyed this video about the history and development of Linux. Making these videos about computer science history is quickly becoming a passion of mine, with many more to come. So if you like this one, subscribe to the channel, as I'm sure you'll like the next ones, like when we dive into the GNU project. Any and all recommendations for future videos are welcome in the comments. And until next time, y'all have a good one.
So the upshot of this is that normally the wealthy and the powerful can hire lots of people in order to do big projects for them. But in the case of the nerds share the work. And the nerds function loosely together. But there's also another thing that nerds do, is nowadays there are lots and lots of open source projects. So what the nerds do is the nerds perceive a need for something. Probably 99% of the time, it is a nerd who perceives a need for himself or herself. And they decide that they need to write something for themselves. But they either realize that this thing is too big for them to do alone, or they do it alone and then they make it open source and put it in public, not only for it to be shared, but for other nerds to come and add to it. Unfortunately, most of you aren't in the world of Linux. But in the world of Linux, I must tell you, I see this like crazy. The whole of Linux is filled with stuff like this. And the things that people write, the whites are constantly creating things that would normally require businesses to create. And the nerds have got all kinds of rules. And they create projects, and the projects are put out on the internet, and certain people can work on it. And there are people that come and go, but they all work on it. And if someone gets sick of working on it or has something else to do, other people come and they continue work. They produce the most amazing software for free. They produce all kinds of software. And because I use Linux and I set up my own servers, I must tell you, all the time, even for my own stuff, for my website and so forth, all the time I say to myself, oh, I need this, I need that. And guess what? I just have to go and find something that other nerds have created for free. Some of the stuff that they create for free is mind-blowing. They will write all kinds of things, and they'll write things to bypass what the big companies are trying to stop you from getting to. There is all kinds of software to download, to copy, to do this, to do that, and even if companies like YouTube and Microsoft, etc., try to stop people from being able to do stuff, the nerds come along and they find ways around it. And they solve the problem. And they go and they write their own stuff, share their own stuff, and nobody can stop them. Let me tell you, nerds have fought the billionaires and beaten the billionaires back more than you can imagine. Nobody stops the nerds. And the more I look at the white right and the more I look at lots of things for free speech and all kinds of things, you'll find that there are some white nerds who'd had a guts full of something, and they decided they're going to take care of matters. And they go and they are able to overcome and beat or engage in never-ending running battles against the billionaires. There is so much freedom on the internet and in the world thanks to nerds. You won't believe it, but nerds have been kicking business and governments and all kinds of people in the teeth for a couple of decades now. And Linux is the greatest creation that has come from nerds. And Linux is dominating certain areas. So Linux might not dominate the business market for normal people to do work, but they dominate other areas. But even if the nerds haven't taken total control of everything, you'll still be amazed at what they have taken control of, even in business, even in the very areas that Windows and Mac dominate. So to give you an example, and pardon the neighbor's dog that can't stop barking. So for Microsoft, for example, while Windows is their prime product, their second biggest product that they make a lot of money out of is Microsoft Office. So Microsoft Office allows you to write documents. It allows you to do email. It allows you to do presentations. It allows you to do spreadsheets, etc. Now, those pieces of software that allow you to do email, spreadsheets, write documents, etc., those pieces of software are themselves very complicated pieces of software that have developed over time, and they've got certain standards. There's a whole bunch of work that's gone into those things. So Microsoft makes a ton of money out of selling Microsoft Office. However, along come nerds. And nerds have created a number of totally open, totally free products that can do virtually everything that Microsoft Office can do. And I myself, I used to be a big Microsoft Office fan. I loved certain things in there, and I didn't at the time know that there were any other similar products out there. And then later I discovered one by one that every single thing that I absolutely have grown to love in Microsoft Office can be obtained for free. And there are certain products that I really liked a lot, and I got to know them very well technically. The Excel spreadsheets, the email system. I used to be almost like a specialist in Microsoft's email stuff. And I loved the presentation software. Well, every single one of those things I now get for free. And not only do I get it for free, but it can work with Microsoft stuff as well as anything else. There is spreadsheet software that is totally free, and it can do virtually everything that Excel can do, and it can work with other formats. And I've been so pleased by that. And email is the same. There's a whole email project that exists that is open source. So there is tons of stuff. And these billionaires, as rich as they are, they can't stop these people. And even if they control most of the market, they cannot dictate to everybody. And anyone who's pissed off and who doesn't want to pay them for their stuff can go and get the same thing totally free. And I will tell you, I've been astounded by the sophistication of the software that nerds have invented for free, built it, put it out there. Sometimes people get tired of a thing or they get bored with it and they don't need it anymore. Then it just lies there and nobody looks after it. But if it's important and lots of people like it, they keep on enhancing that stuff, you would be astounded what people come up with. And when you get to know more about things like Bitcoin and crypto, you will start to understand that nerds have yet again beaten everybody, that nerds have gone to the next level, that nerds are busy creating currencies for the world. So all of this has come from simply having a method of working. In this case, it was computers, having a method of working, having a method of sharing. So the nerds write the software, they have a way of putting the software in places, they have methods of controlling the software, working as a team. Different people can work on different parts of it and can put it back in, and all the time everything will function. The nerds have solved all those problems. So you basically get vast numbers of nerds, and all these nerds are busy working in their own time, enhancing stuff, putting it together, sharing it, and then it goes out as ever improved products. And this work is going on flat out all the time. And it's simply labor. Basically, you've got nerds who are functioning like Nazis. They are working and working and working and working for free and working as teams and collaborating and continuing, and they're just building bigger and bigger and bigger stuff all the time. I must tell you, when I think about robotics and science and what I've seen in software, let me tell you, you have by no means seen the end of what computer software can do. Between computers and software and robotics and space travel, let me tell you, when I sit and think about where this could lead to, let me tell you, the ultimate objective of this might be more incredible and more insane than you can imagine. That given a few hundred years, nerds might be starting to do all kinds of things across galaxies that you wouldn't even believe. They would probably start moving planets and moving stars and moving universes. When I sit and think about where computer software and robotics can lead to, I'm telling you, it's not going to take long, and whites are going to have power that previously you would have thought only God himself could have. You have no idea where this is going. And when I look at it, I must tell you, I think it's going to be incredible beyond all imagination. Especially when you get to robotics, because robotics is software, computer software, working with physical machines. And once you get to that, and you've got robots that are flying in the atmosphere, robots that are traveling through space, and you start getting robots that start building other robots, I want to tell you, the universe will belong to planet Earth. I mean, just a couple of months ago, they had a spacecraft crash into an asteroid in order to change the asteroid's orbit. And they've already checked that, and it's worked better than they expected. When our civilization builds robots that build robots, and all those robots get out there into the universe, I want to tell you, we will be running the universe from planet Earth. So let's look at the consequences of some of this. Basically, nerds have gone and they've actually stopped guys like Bill Gates and others from completely controlling everything in computers. Nerds have stopped that. Nerds have gone and by making things free, they have sucked huge amounts of money, enormous amounts of money, away from businesses. And they've also allowed lots and lots of people, a lot more people than you could ever have imagined if they'd had to pay, they've allowed vast numbers of people to have access to software and abilities that they would never have been able to afford. Furthermore, the nerds cannot be controlled. So Bill Gates and all the rich people of the world cannot stop the nerds. The things the nerds have bought cannot be bought. They cannot come and pay people off in order to get those things. Those things are there, those things are in public, they are free, and they are there for everybody on Earth. So, all the super rich, the Rothschilds and everybody cannot stop the nerds. And the nerds have permanently dented their businesses. And some of those businesses, many of those businesses, now need the products that the nerds created for the world. The nerds have beaten the rich, and the rich can't stop them. Nobody can stop them. At the end of the day, what these nerds are doing is actually democracy in action. It's actually, that's what it really boils down to. Now, let me give you another example of computer nerds or geeks taking on the wealthy. Microsoft was unpopular when it came out and they were trying to control everything and you had to have a license for this. Then after a time, there were computer viruses. And computer viruses were a big thing. I remember that at a point, computer viruses were getting out of hand. Computer viruses still exist. But here's something that non-technical people might not know. And it is that the vast majority of computer viruses, probably anything from 95 to 99%, probably more like 99% of all computer viruses which were ever written, were written for Windows. They were written to smash Windows. Linux hardly has any viruses. There are very few viruses on Linux. Very few. For the most part, on Linux, I don't know of anybody who's even bothered to install antivirus software for Linux because there's hardly any. So, my understanding from years ago was that a lot of these viruses came from people who specifically targeted Windows. They specifically hated Bill Gates and his thing, and they weren't just always criminals, because lots of viruses can't steal money. They just came and they'd destroy your machine, they'd destroy your data, etc. And my understanding was that at a point, there were a lot of viruses that were written by people who simply hated Windows. Of course, then business got into the act, and it was a battle between people making money out of writing antivirus software because the businesses needed to survive. So that became a whole industry of antivirus software. But the point is that Linux, which is seen as friendly and free, doesn't have the kind of focus of viruses that you have with Windows. Okay, in the case of Windows, you do have lots of businesses and they could be trying to steal money from you. But that isn't the only reason that people wrote viruses. There definitely were people, and lots of people, who wrote viruses just because they hated Windows. And that had to have had a huge impact as well. And there are many people who've supported Linux for no reason than that it is not owned by anyone. I have a German friend, and he put his entire business on Linux simply because he didn't want to be controlled through Microsoft and people sneaking around, etc. Just notice that when it came to the dodgy stuff, I started blaming the geeks as well. Being a nerd, I didn't want to smear nerds with the virus stuff. But the point is that here you can see that if you work out a mechanism and there is a method in there, that you can actually have lots of people working with each other, giving of their time as and how they can, and it results in something enormous. And I must tell you that there has to be some of this type of thinking that I think could really give us additional power. The white right, in many ways, is already partly a home along these lines, but I'm sure that there is more that you can do. I will leave it to people to sit and think about, but I hope you are starting to appreciate that there is a huge amount of stuff that people can do that the billionaires can't stop. In the white right, by the way, if I sit and think about it, in the white right, people started creating memes. And people create memes and they share memes on their social media platforms. So that is a lot like open source. And nowadays we do the same thing with videos and audios and books and that type of stuff, where we've got either people in groups or people in email chains and they send things from one to the other. All of that functions sort of like open source. But many times people are negative and people are despondent and people think that you can't win, when in fact we are making progress and we are winning. So I want you to look at Linux and open source and say to yourself, look at that, look at the power that came out of that. Look at the insane power that's come out of that. And all the wealthiest men in the world couldn't stop Linux. And Linux is out there, and Linux is still growing, and it's always moving on to the next level. And it's got an enormous impact worldwide, and yet it was created without any capital. No capital, just labor. Just labor and clever people. Clever people working together and building all kinds of things and sharing things. And look at that. And look carefully at the economic impact. Look at what it allows. So there have to be lessons in this, that maybe there are other kinds of things that we can create that can make life easier for whites. So if you can look at that, then there has to be positive stuff that can come out of this kind of concept of working together. The white right itself, if it only doesn't lose its faith in itself, the white right itself could ultimately be the free speech platform for the world and do for politics what Linux has done for technology. But it could create foundations and platforms, maybe for whole societies of whites. And I'm not talking technologically, I'm talking about maybe there are methods of organization and working together that we need to think about for whites to exist. And once you get some kind of idea and some method of working together, we could maybe build villages, maybe even build cities or economies, as long as we function in some kind of method along these types of lines. And by doing so, you will cut the costs for other people. So Linux and all its millions of offshoots in terms of software utilities and all kinds of things that have come out of it, there's tons and tons and tons of stuff that's come out of Linux. And it's all free, and it's been done by all kinds of people just doing their little bit. Like I say, it's like democracy in action. And it is stable. It is not affected by stock markets. It is not affected by the rich. It's a method of thinking and working together as a team. And it has not only created stuff with all kinds of capabilities that people can use who would never have had access to something like this, but it's cut the costs. It's cut the costs of everybody who needs to use that kind of stuff. I think that certain aspects of Linux are more labor intensive, but the power that you get is amazing. So you're looking at some kind of Nazi type, National Socialist type of thing that's come here and it can compete. And like I say, keep watching crypto. Keep watching crypto. Crypto is a similar thing to open source. Now what I'm going to do is we're going to go to the next level. The next level is socialism in action. Real socialism that actually works. And it's my favorite example, my all-time favorite Christians at work, the Hutterites. So for those who've not looked at the Hutterites, let me explain. What you've got is a method of working together, people who believe in something, in this case whites. The whites get together and they work together and they come together as a community, they buy a farm, they put their capital together due to their beliefs. They're not supposed to own property. And so, in order to get around that, the way that they live is through teamwork. And they've been living like this for 500 years. And these particular Hutterites that we're going to take a look at are Hutterites in Canada and America. And these Hutterites do something that you would think is impossible. You have been taught that socialism is not possible, that socialism does not work, that socialism is evil. Well, in this case, you're going to see very religious, hard-working white men and women, and they are able in their sectors, they are able to beat big companies. They can compete against all kinds of businesses, and they are more efficient than those businesses. By working as a team and sharing their stuff and competing in the business world, they actually end up beating other businesses. They can even drive other farmers out of business. And they can do things on a scale that other people can't do. For me, the Hutterites are the prime example of socialism in the modern world. And it shows you the power of socialism. What amazes me even more about the Hutterites is how few of them it requires for them to get going and get off the ground. It doesn't take many of them. When you have a Hutterite colony of 100 men, women, and children, they are fully functional and they are humming. And the other thing about the Hutterites is that the Hutterites are winning in every conceivable way. They not only score and survive financially, but they are constantly building up their asset base, and most amazingly, they are having lots of children. Lots of children. So they are growing, and they are also growing their population at a hell of a pace. And prior to liberals interfering with them, they used to double their population every 20 years. They used to double their population every 20 years. So they're not only doubling their population, they are totally and utterly financially fine, and they can look after themselves completely. They have just focused, though, on farming. But when I look at the Hutterite model, I must tell you, this thing can go further. I've said before that this Hutterite concept could be expanded into villages and cities even. And imagine you had something like that. Imagine you had a whole city of Hutterites, and that, let's say, you had 500,000 people, and 20 years later, you've got 1 million white people. But in the case of the Hutterites, they go and they spawn new colonies. If white people lived like this, we'd be an unstoppable force. We would be unstoppable on planet Earth. So take a look at these Hutterites. After the Hutterites, I want to bring a couple of more things into this. And then you'll see that I think there are tons of ways that whites could move forward. What I'm going to show you is a tiny community of whites. They number between 100 and 170. And you're about to see what they produce and how they live. Look at this and be amazed. And remember, it's a small community of 100 to 170 white men, women, and children. So it's not big. Look at what they own, look at what they do.
You might be wondering at this point what the men are doing. Well, the men do the fields. They get their machinery ready, they get their stuff fixed up, and make their abode into the fields. And that's where they basically hang out for a month-ish, give or take. There's seeding, there's spraying, there's harrowing. Just, there's a bunch of stuff that has to get done, and that's in the men's compartment. Let me show you what they do during this wonderful season.
As much as we love spring and the magic of it, so to say, there is no one that appreciates spring more than the children. They've been cooped up all winter long. They're dying to be outside, and they are making the most of every moment.
endured approximately 21 springs in my lifetime. And the miracle of spring just never ceases to amaze me. It's such a miraculous time. We're coming from the dead of winter, and we come in here, and there's new life everywhere you look. There's newness. There's new babies. There's new animals. There's new sprouts. There's new greenery. It is a beautiful time, and I am here for it. They're all following me. How is this supposed to work? You like your machine?
Nothing wrong like a deer.
I didn't think I can classify my next part here as a miracle, but it definitely falls under the category of new and baby. So I'm heading to a dealership pretty quick, and there I'll be driving my dad's brand new Ford pickup out and home. I've never sat in a brand new pickup, and I've never driven one out of the dealer lot. I understand that's a privilege not many people can attain. However, I get the special privileges of attaining it. My brothers are both seating, and so the birthright falls on me. Thanks, Dad. So that's what we're going to do, and that is actually sort of kind of a miracle. It's on my bucket list. Check!
Adina, you here?
Hi, Brett.
Here's the key for your brand new 2021 F-150.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you.
Enjoy the truck.
Thank you.
Thank you for the business.
You betcha. Check out my new ride. Oh, yeah. How do you like your new ride?
Just sitting here and letting it sink in.
Hey, Kurt. Look at my new ride. Right over there. Hi. You trying to hijack my car, man? And my...
I'm hijacking your glasses.
Give me my glasses. It's a deal of a lifetime, hey.
You want me to show you the truck and how everything works?
That would be great.
Okay, so these seats fold up flat.
Ooh!
You'll have to play around with all the different features in the truck.
Oh, no problem. All right, so let's get this baby started. So all you gotta do, as I've heard, is you press the brake, and then you press this button here. Just kidding. I've been doing this for a while already. So, let's get this truck a moving. Now, I've heard the next thing you do is you take this and you bring it down to D. And then you just start adding some kilometers. Okay, we're gonna do that. I'm gonna head out of here.
Necessary goods, such as clothing, typically are distributed to each family at a designated time each year, although colonies differ in such administrative practices. This truly communal sharing of all things separates Hutterites even from other Anabaptist traditions, such as the Amish or the Mennonites. Like those communities, however, the Hutterites reserve baptism for adults. Years of preparation and an examination before the community precede the momentous decision. No Hutterite is ever required to be baptized, but only the baptized can marry or hold an office of leadership. Life in a Hutterite community is centered around work, both to maintain the colony's independence from the world and to ensure that each member avoids the temptations of idleness. To a Hutterite, honest work will always involve labor. To buy goods and resell them at a profit with no labor of one's own is sinful. A new colony will be founded whenever an existing colony has too many members to keep everyone occupied with work. The workday can begin as early as 3:30 in the morning and end as late as 10 at night. Women perform household tasks such as laundry, cleaning, or preparing the colony's communal meals. Men typically work in agriculture or agriculture-related specialties such as repairing machinery. To ensure that everyone's time is occupied, men who work in agriculture during the summer often spend the winter learning a different trade. Tasks are assigned by community leaders, taking into account each member's abilities. Although there is plenty of work to fill the day, ample time is allowed for breaks and meals. Men who complete their work early often will assist those who have not, so that the community's work as a whole is completed. With time rigidly structured and minutely divided into tasks, workdays pass quickly.
So, those are the Hutterites, my favorite Christians. The Hutterites just don't shoot. They just are peaceniks. The Hutterites, though, are one step away from being Nazis. But the Hutterites are proof that teamwork and socialism can take on the rich. And I repeat, the amazing thing is that it works so well even for small groups. Groups as small as 100 people or so can set up a community, and it doesn't take them too long to benefit from that, and they can cut their costs while creating income, and when it's all over, these people are wealthy. They are actually wealthy, and they can take on anybody. In my more complete Hutterite video, I showed some of the enormous projects that Hutterites can do that even big businesses can't do, because the Hutterites can think for 20 and 30 years in advance, and they've got the capital to do insanely huge projects. That is really teamwork at its finest. And I must tell you, if Hutterites can do it with colonies of between 100 and 170 people, I don't see why you can't take this to a whole different level. If it can work for 100 people, why can't it work for 100 million people? So let's go back to some of those previous things where the farmers, for example, were fighting John Deere. There was John Deere trying to control the farmers, and because it's software plus advanced engineering, the farmers were struggling. Though the farmers are fighting back, and the farmers are not totally useless, the farmers are able to fight back. But let's take it one step further. Imagine that we could have tractors and harvesters that run on open source software. Imagine that. Imagine we had harvesters and advanced equipment that's running on open source software. Then those farmers wouldn't have a problem. The nerds are well placed. Nerds and engineers are well placed to solving that problem and putting John Deere and everybody else in their place. Then John Deere, Mercedes-Benz, etc., won't be able to actually stop and control physical machines. And ditto for all these other electronics devices. All you need is to do open source free stuff for electronics and robotics, and you have got the means to kill off the power of those companies. Those companies will be stopped dead in their tracks. And again, the white right has itself pioneered many things. We knock ourselves a lot, but in reality, we are the pioneers of free speech. We in the white right are doing what the corporates should be doing, but aren't doing. So people in the white right mustn't knock themselves. Truly, we are the ones that are going down the path to really solving the problem. But if we bring in some of these other concepts, like the nerd concepts of open source, the Hutterite concepts of community or working together, I must tell you that it's simply a case of organizing and grouping ourselves together. And I can't see how the rich can destroy us. Because even in the instances where you do need capital, you can obtain it from other people. And you can obtain it from your group so that it doesn't come from the enemy. There are many ways of solving that. If we even look at Adolf Hitler, Adolf Hitler was able to raise most of his money without using banks. That is a thing that Leon de Grel brought up. That's a special thing that we need to go and visit. But Leon de Grel explained that Hitler raised most of his money without needing even his own bank. He raised some money from the bank, but it was peanuts compared to what he could raise from people. In Hitler's case, he had a thing called the MIFO bond, and he was able to basically draw capital. He was basically able to draw capital from normal Germans, and the government paid the interest not to the wealthy, but to the people. So when I look at all these things, and one brings all these things together, I don't see why we can't create things on almost any scale. Given enough time and enough work, I think that we can do almost anything. And what if we start bringing together the little businesses that normal whites own? If normal whites start networking more with other normal whites, we network more together, and we see to it that we channel business to each other, and we could even see to it that we don't ban each other. So we treat each other properly, and we help each other in all various ways. And if you can increase the size of our networks, then we could get to the point where we could either have buying power or selling power. And we could have things like that also coming into the mix. But if we created everything as a white network that sticks together and works in all sorts of ways to assist each other, I cannot see that there is any limit to this thing, and this thing could become very, very powerful. And later on, this thing could start having the power to do things that normally the very wealthy would be able to do. I've not touched on the topic of banking. That's another topic that I want to tackle separately in a shorter video. Because even that is easier than you think. The more I look at this, the more I say to myself, if whites work together and whites keep the enemy out, I don't see any limit to what we can do. And we won't have people that can come and destroy us. And any kind of pain that we are suffering, that we can, with time, work out solutions to this. Money is great as a motivational factor and as a way of you doing some work and you get what you are worth. But what has happened in our world is that money has become perverted and subverted. And Jews are the main force perverting something that should be working absolutely fine. And now they are trying to kick us around in all sorts of ways. So if we use our brains and our skill and what bits of capital we have, and we work together, and we work out methods of working together, I frankly cannot see why we can't end up winning endlessly. That we should be able to claw back all the kinds of things that the wealthy have tried to smash us down with, that we should be able to take them on. And if we work together as a team, then we should in many ways be able to match them and beat them in almost everything. I cannot see why we can't beat them at everything. That this nonsense of big companies coming and beating down on individuals over free speech, beating down on farmers to force them to behave in a certain way so that they make money out of the farmer. What if the common white hits back and we smash, we compete and defeat the rich? Because the super rich are controlling politics, the super rich are controlling big companies and banks, and they control a whole bunch of stuff, and they have got no problem kicking us in the teeth and telling us how society must work. Why can't whites over time organize in many different ways and tackle these different areas and defeat them? Because all it requires is that we just make sure that they never control our stuff, that it belongs to us, that it works in our networks, and that we function like those open source things or the Hutterites. I don't see why the super rich need to dominate everything and that we have to always be on the bottom and bowing down to them. I think that we can destroy them and break their power using teamwork and clever concepts like these nerds, like these Hutterites. And that big companies can be made to cry, because I cannot see a single thing that whites, if they function as a group, I can't see a single industry or a single kind of unit that cannot be replaced if we just come up with the right concepts and the right teamwork. That we should be able to get back everything, all our freedoms, and have the ability that the rich cannot come and kick us in the teeth. And one thing about computers and the internet is that it allows us to cooperate in a way that we've never been able to do before. Previously, being global was just the area of the Jews and the super rich. But now it can be for all whites. It is there already for all whites. We just have to start filling in the pieces. Anything is possible, actually. So give this some thought, because in the world of the internet, lots of things are possible. In South Africa, I've noticed that we are getting smaller and smaller banks. And as someone who used to work in banks, I knew that 99% of all the stuff that's happening in the banks is actually being done by computers. And we've actually got some teeny weeny banks that are run just by computers that are so small, and they don't have physical banking offices that you go to. They just function on an ATM and a card, and off you go. And technology is moving to the point where the common person, common people, will have more and more freedom. We are getting so close. But if we worked as a team, there's no reason, if we created lots and lots of teams, and those teams started functioning in different technologies and different business areas, and white businesses supported other white businesses, man, I cannot see that they can stop us. So ponder this, and if you ever come across other technology or other forms of organization of whites, let me know, because I'm certain that we can do stuff. I'm absolutely certain we can do things. And that the white right must also not be so negative and must see itself as something like that open source that I've discussed there. We've already got our alternatives to YouTube. YouTube tried to crush us all. And what came of it? Out of it came BitChute, Odyssey, and even people like myself with my own video platform. But if this can extend into money and into, let's say, politics and campaign finance, maybe banking, maybe other areas, other industries, I gotta tell you, man, I think that all kinds of insane things are possible. And these rich scum who became so arrogant in recent decades that they're going to be very sorry that they came and kicked us all in the teeth, that they will be put in their place, and that all whites will be free again to think how they want to think and do what they want to do.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, thank the whites.